Grilling at home probably isn't the same as grilling at a restaurant, at least not in most restaurants and probably not in most homes. There may be a similar heat source, probably gas, but the speed necessary at that restaurant grill is much higher, much faster. Do you grill at home? Do you do burgers or whole chickens? Have you ever coated something in breadcrumbs and then grilled it? The Eating Liberty Podcast, episode 262, Food and Freedom, once a week for life. Hello, folks. Dan Reed here. Welcome back to the podcast. The Escoffier series continues in Chapter 7 with grilling. Now, we've got only one more section to go, and that is deep frying. And that'll be fun, because I've got a really horrible story. But today is grilling. Now, grilling seems easy enough. Make a fire, wait for the coals, put the meat on the hot grate, and cook it till it's done. Easy peasy, right? Grilling really isn't much more than that. Oh, there's a whole lot of fancy and expensive contraptions you can buy to make your coals nice and hot and ready and get your hot grate ready to go. But the actual cooking is fundamentally the same. Well, it's a talking heads moment, same as it ever was. Escoffier identifies four classifications, that's what he calls them, of things to be grilled. Red meat, for example, beef or mutton or game, by which I'm sure he means the four-legged kind. White meat, veal, lamb, I know, and chicken, and game birds, I expect. Fish, plain enough, and the fourth one. And he writes, quote, those foods which have been simply coated with breadcrumbs or have been egg and breadcrumbed, end quote. Yes, you heard that right. Breadcrumbed food on the grill. I'm going to get to that. For Escoffier, the right fuel for a grill is charcoal. Now, part of this is to recall that back in 1860s and 70s, they may have had gas grills. I don't really know. I'm not entirely sure. But charcoal is his preferred choice. And what I'm sure he means is proper wood charcoal, not the stuff in the bag. In the passage he wrote, he was talking to restaurant chefs. Now, he makes a point about adequate ventilation, which seems reasonable, and also to make sure the grill has a draft for air for the coals. Also, for the fuel, avoid those fuels which may give off smoke, which may give an unpleasant flavor to the food. Now, we seem sort of to like smoked foods, but smoking deliberately and smoking accidentally are different, and a flare-up from fat dripping onto a coal might not make pleasant smoke flavor. Now, the other reason for a draft source is to allow that ventilation system something to extract should any smoke flare-up happen. Now, it also, that ventilation system is going to take some of the heat with it. Having stood in front of a restaurant grill for a little while, well, it gets hot. So more than a few of us now grill outside, so smoker fumes or heat isn't really an indoor problem. The need for a proper draft, however, does remain to allow all of that stuff to happen. So grilling on a hearth has returned to favor, maybe only slightly, which makes a real art of grilling on coals easy for me to say. A hearth will have a source of wood or charcoal and a bed of coals laid thin on one side and stacked high on another side. That's for a concentration of or reduction in radiant heat. Now, I did a whole episode on hearth grilling and the Kenyan wood cooking. There's more than a few books about that, but I sort of actually want to make one at my house. I just don't know where to put it because I've got a tree problem, and I don't want one problem to make bigger problems. But a good hearth is probably going to be 5 or 6 feet wide because you need to have wood to one side and room for all this stuff to happen. But sounds like a lot of fun. In most restaurants, they have this iron contraption with gas jets under it and probably some kind of ceramic briquette thing, which is intended to diffuse the flame heat so that there's more, it's still hot as can be, but it's a flame shooting up is going to be hot right in that spot. The ceramic tiles, briquettes, sort of diffuse that to radiate a more even, very high heat. So those grills usually have two positions, off or on. Now, on is hot as hell. Now, savvy grill cooks will turn one side down a little bit to allow for big meats to cook more slowly, and we're going to get into this a little bit. But the other reason that they're going to turn that down is while they're at the grill, they can also be sautéing some things that their dish might need. So they get out of the way of the guys on the other side. Girls, too. Now, it was the thinking, and in some places it might still be the thinking, that searing meat keeps the juices in. It does not. It never has. Searing makes awesome flavor, but never, ever, ever was it waterproof. And we'll sort of reveal that here in just a minute. Escoffier's basic advice for grilling meats is the same as for roasts. The smaller the piece of meat, the higher the heat and the shorter the cooking time for that particular portion of meat. Large pieces of meat on the grill, the Chateaubriand, for example, requires initial high heat for the good sear and those nice dark lines from the grill on the meat, then lower heat to allow the inside to cook. Take a Chateaubriand cooked on too high of a heat and the outside risks burning, and the inside remains raw or undercooked. And then you get a bigger problem of, I don't know if they do this much anymore. Sometimes places like Bennigan's, which probably went the way of Boston Chicken, they used to have Sunday brunch with this giant steamship or a big roasted thing at the end of the buffet line. And if you ever go through a buffet line that has a big roast in there at the end of it, and you look at the roast and it's gray, then bangs, red, this big slug of red in the middle. There's no gray. There's two colors, gray and red. Well, that's a visual clue that this thing was not cooked correctly, and everything that's not red is going to be dry as sand. So if you can't get a nice red piece of meat from the end of the buffet line, it's probably best to avoid it because there isn't enough au jus to make it palatable, personally. That's kind of what the risk is with the Chateaubriand at too high of a heat. You're going to cook the outside and then the inside half inch or whatever, depends how long you leave it on there. And so you get this little slug of red inside. There's no gradation. There's no craft involved. And if you're talking about a Chateaubriand, we definitely want craft. Now, those fancy contraptions, I have one, it's propane, do allow four different temperature settings. I have three knobs, so two can be on Inferno and one can be not so much. One can be Arizona. But It does not seem that very often I'm cooking 2 pounds of beef tenderloin in the form of a Chateaubriand. It doesn't happen here. So for doneness, today, mostly we use meat thermometers, and that's probably a really good idea, especially when it comes to poultry. Now, I do use my thermometer for my tri-tip since it seizes pretty firmly and the touch test is tricky. Now, the other thing about a tri-tip is it's a very dense, muscular piece of meat, and that's, well, duh, it's muscle. Well, the tenderloin isn't dense. It's fairly, tenderloin's kind of a boring piece of meat, but it's very soft. Tri-tip has done some work. So meat that does work is going to be trickier to touch test. And the other thing about the tri-tip is, they vary in size, but it's going to carry up easily 15 degrees. Now, in case that's a term you don't know, carry up means that if you cook it on the grill and the temperature reads 120 degrees, when you take it off the grill, wrap it up. Now, for tri-tip, I'd wrap it up in foil, then wrap it into a plastic bag, then wrap it in kitchen towels so it's nice and insulated. As it sits there for half an hour, yes, 30 minutes, no kidding, it's going to go from 120 to 135. Your Thanksgiving turkey will carry over, will carry up. Turkey will probably go, it could go 20, 25, 30 degrees, depending on how big the bird is. And that's why you let it rest. So several things happen. The meat proteins start to relax. So they're not in the high heat anymore. So now they are changing composition. There's a lot chemically going on inside with all the juices and the stuff. But the main thing is, as that meat rests, either that 2 pound tri-tip or that 16 pound turkey, as the meat rests, the juices start to reassimilate into those protein fibers. And then when you cut into it, the juice stays in the meat where it's supposed to be. Now, so I've covered this on Thanksgiving episodes before, but letting even your steak rest is a good idea. And we're going to talk about that in a minute, too. It's all coming up. So temperature for my tri-tip to make sure I get it to the right spot. And Escoffier's advice for cooking meat is this, quote, "The surest way to ascertain the correct degree of being cooked is the appearance of pinkish colored drops of blood on the brown surface of the meat," end quote. First of all, it isn't blood, it's myoglobin, that's the whole of the story, but he sort of accidentally reveals the point that a good sear on the meat isn't waterproof. So my offering about that well-cooked pinkish color drops on the brown surface of the meat is then to let it rest. Even the steak. Alain Ducasse, a multiple many-starred Michelin chef, thinks that steaks should rest half as long as it took to cook them. So if you cook your steak for 5 minutes, let it rest 10. No, sorry, backwards. Maybe. Cook it for 10, let it rest 5. So one thing about thermometers, they make a hole. Duh. The chief issue is that hole is now a way for the juices that were inside to come outside. And they will, and they'll come with some force because the cooking part, roasting, sautéing, grilling is really exciting the water, which is part of what's inside. And it's getting hot, it's getting active. The molecules are very excited and they want to go someplace. When you make a hole in it, or when you cut it to check the doneness, they're all, hey, look, there's a way out. And they take it. So that's one of the reasons the finger test is much preferred, because it doesn't cut the meat. It just sort of tests it for what the doneness is. And that takes some skill. It takes a lot of practice. So get cooking. There is a way to use the thermometer, especially on bigger cuts of meat, to determine doneness without risking this evacuation of juices from the meat. And that is the kind of thermometer that either has a long wire probe on it and you read it, the temperature externally, say it's like 4 foot piece of wire, or some thermometers are actually oven proof, oven resistant probably. So put the thermometer in the meat when it's raw. And as it cooks, you can watch its temperature increase, leave the thermometer or the probe in the meat, even when it's rusting. Take it out only when you're ready to cut it or to eat it so that you are not making that evacuation route. And those are pretty handy things to use. White meats do not get the same high heat treatment as red meats. Now, Escoffier does include lamb as a white meat, which if you've seen lamb, that's a really hard thing to figure out. From the text, it seems his inclusion of lamb there is due to the animal's relative youth. Mutton is included as a red meat, and for probably damn good reason. By the text, it seems he's not cooking a whole loin of veal to then be carved tableside. Now, that would be a really nice show. Instead, it seems he's cooking thin fillets of lamb or veal or breast of chicken or breast of pheasant. So, if you're a hunter, and maybe you already know this, pheasant breast is fantastic. Pheasant breast actually, now, the gamey stuff that you buy in the store versus what you hunt outside, they're probably more similar than not. Pheasant breast could go to an easy to a medium. Cooking pheasant breast well done, like we do with chicken, probably be a less pleasant experience. Pheasant legs, that's a whole other ballgame, and they need to be braised, and there's a really an awesome procedure for that, which is not for this show, but chicken legs are fine on the grill, pheasant legs not so much. In Escoffier, for all cases, for white meat, moderate heat is the proper heat, and the duration is determined by sort of the size of the thing. So a thin piece of veal or a whole chicken breast is not the same. But really, you're looking for that nice browned outside and a juicy inside. Now, the tip for doneness for white meats is when the juices escape, they should run completely clear. Now, I have an issue with this, and that would be the issue on lamb. If your lamb juices run clear, I think you've made pencil erasers, and so I would dispute the need for that. I think you really want to shoot for a medium rare on a lamb. Veal, and I'm not sure medium rare veal is particularly good. If it depends on the cut, like a loin piece, maybe if you pound it out and just like a, or hang on, I'm going to take that all back. If a veal tenderloin, like a little mini veal tornado, that would be fine medium rare. And then that would be another instance where the juices would not run clear. But on poultry, we definitely want to see that, certainly for chicken. On to fish. All fish, large or small, get moderate heat. They should be brushed with clarified butter or olive oil frequently to ensure that they don't dry out and also helps protect the outside of the fish. The oil also aids in creating an attractive color. Now, there is an issue. The obvious issue is we're grilling on something and we're putting oil on top of this thing. And if we're a little eager in our brushing, oil will drip onto the heat below and either flare up, which will cause carbon, or at least smoke and things we can. So it's like, wait a minute, you do it carefully. That's how you do it. I wish I had a better answer for you than that. Carefully. Now, Escoffier recommends a light dusting of flour on fish to be grilled, which creates something of a bit of a crust. He writes, this helps them from drying out, a position I disagree with, and it creates an attractive appearance, which I do agree with. fish on the bone, whole salmon. It could be whole mullet. Mullet isn't, well, mullet's very specific to a particular place. Mullet isn't amazing, but if you're cast netting mullet to go snook fishing, mullet's free. Lake perch, probably better as fillets, but if they're really small, maybe bone on. When the fillets start to pull away from the bone, then the fish is cooked. Now, the fillet part is a whole other story, and that's a completely different problem because, say, you're dealing with that little lake perch or fillet of sole, and also a side of salmon, not a side of salmon, a fillet of salmon and a tunica. We have three separate problems here. Fillet of sole is very thin and cooks very quickly. Portion of salmon is not thin and will not cook quickly. And getting to the proper doneness, or at least in today's market, the mostly preferred doneness of medium-ish. Some folks are more medium rare-ish. It's pushing it for me. That depends on the heat on the grill. It depends on the thickness of the fish. So those are some variations that cannot easily be given. This is how you tell it's done. Tuna in today's market, today's restaurant market, is mostly served rare, and in some restaurants, that means raw with either a quick sear on both sides or a high heat grill marks on both sides, and then that's it. Generally, it's cold in the middle. Now, so there's no way to say this is how you know when this is done. Now for that last category, breadcrumbed food. The Scoffier doesn't burden us with the specifics of what it is to be grilled. He writes, quote, "Items are food which are coated with dry breadcrumbs, butter and breadcrumbs, or with egg and breadcrumbs are usually small in size. They must be grilled over a very moderate heat in order to cook through and at the same time color the coating," end quote. So it's a bit of a struggle to think about what would that food thing be. I don't know. I've tried doing this a couple times, and I was more frustrated than satisfied. He also adds that those food items are to be basted carefully so as to avoid flare-ups and also to avoid brushing off the coatings. Well, just, man, talk about making things hard. If I'm going to cook something that's been breadcrumbed, now let's say it's a breadcrumbed piece of zucchini or yellow squash or eggplant's a possibility. That would fit. Possibly a real thin slice of chicken breast or veal or some thin pieces of meat, thin pieces of sole would work. Instead of on the grill, I would find griddling much easier, and also a much better color, and sort of save the headaches of brushing off the thing you're trying to keep on. So there's four things of grilling. Now here's the big part. You have food on the grill. How do you get food off the grill, or how do you turn it? Now I have not been shy or infrequent about expressing my hatred for tongs. Yes, that's a very powerful feeling for a kitchen tool. Except for very few occasions, getting a hot, heavy pan out of the back of the oven or reaching into a deep fryer, I have no use for tongs, as found on nearly every search engine looking for tongs. Escoffier recommends a palette knife, which I would call an offset. They're probably going to be called decorating spatula or offset spatulas, pastry spatulas, but anything like that is, I think, much preferred, as well as, or in addition to, a what cooks call a tuning fork. Now, there's two main kinds of forks in a commercial kitchen. One is a roasting fork, which has a really sturdy shaft leading to short curved tines. It's intended to really, you jab that into the meat and you lift it up and put it in the pan. And it's sturdy, it's heavy, it's got some heft to it. A tuning fork literally looks like a tuning fork. It's two long tines that don't curve, and the kitchen implement, the tines come to a point. Those tines fit ever so nicely between the grates on a grill. So if you've got a piece of salmon, now salmon's kind of wonky because if you're in a restaurant and the person doing the cutting didn't account for the belly flap, which is very thin, and the middle part, which is not very thin, the belly flap's going to cook well before the rest of the piece of fish. So either you cut it off or you fold it over, but if that hasn't happened, when you go to lift this piece of fish off, or even a piece of chicken with halves, you've got edges which are thin-ish compared to the middle. Sometimes the piece of thin food is going to stick to the grill. The tuning fork lets you get in, and with lifting it up and the palette knife scraping, if you need to, on the grill grate, you can release that piece of food with relative grace and ease. A tong only grabs the outside, and if there's a piece stuck, it's not going to unstuck it, and you're going to tear your piece of fish, tear your piece of meat, and it just looks a fright. And so in a restaurant, you've just ruined a portion. You put the whole meal back to 20 minutes. At home, it's just frustrating. The other problem I have with tongs is if you get this really nice, good grill grates, you got a nice crosshatch, you've turned it over, you got a nice crosshatch on the bottom, and you stick the tongs under the fish, under the chicken, and squeeze down, and you cut into, because the tong ends curve a little bit, and they don't look sharp, but they will cut the surface of the food, and now it's just, I hate them. There's just no reason that they should be used except for deep fryers and hot heavy pans. So, a palette knife, an offset spatula, a tuning fork. I think those are better ways to preserve the beauty and integrity of a well-cooked thing on the grill. All right, folks, that's going to do it. I'll add a link to a thermometer that can, in fact, take the heat. It also is excellent for smokers, and it's a probe that has a wire. So you put the probe in the brisket in the smoker, and the wire sits out on the thermometer part, the reader, and that sits outside the smoker. And you can even get a fancy one that will Bluetooth to your phone, so while you're watching your favorite football game, this brisket's doing it, you can check your phone and say, oh, it's time to get up and go do something. So that's a fun thing to have. And I will add that link on the show notes page for today, which is culinarylibertarian.com/262. Have a good week, and I'll see you soon.
Music for the Culinary Libertarian podcast is provided by Matthew Bankert at mattbankert.com.